intermarriage. Well, why should I talk about intermarriage in the United States of America? I don't know. Anyway, yeah, intermarriage and halachic creativity, reading the Book of Ruth. Yeah, the Book of Ruth, I'm sure that all of you are actually familiar with the story. It's a classical story, but you know the best definition of classics, it's literature that you are afraid to say that we haven't read. So let me tell you, let me take like 120 seconds to tell you the story of Ruth, famine in the land of Israel, nothing new under the sun, a family, Naomi, her husband Elimelech, and their two kids are leaving the country for Moab. In Moab, the two sons are marrying Moabite wives. The two sons die. The father dies. And Naomi is heading back to the land of Judah, to Bethlehem. Her two daughters-in-law insist on following her to Bethlehem, which is the greatest miracle of the Bible. She tries to convince them to stay behind. She succeeds with Mahlon, with Orpah, but Ruth decides to follow her. They get to Bethlehem. They are very poor. Poor Ruth has to glean in the fields of Bethlehem. She gleans in the field of Boaz, a very rich Judahite who is their relative, Naomi's relative, and he actually shows his great generosity to her in his field. Naomi has now some plans for Ruth. She wants her to marry Boaz. She sends her to the threshing floor in the night time. She gets there. She performs some symbolic act. She uncovers his feet, and he understands the message, but he tells her, look, we have to wait for the morning. I have some legal procedures to go through in the morning in the gate. In the gate, well, there is one person who is a closer relative of Naomi, and he has the right of the first refusal. And he indeed refuses to take Ruth. He doesn't want a Moabite wife. So at the end, of course, Boaz marries her. God is very happy with the shidduch, and she gets pregnant. She has a son. And that's the lineage of King David, you know. So that's the story. Now we can actually start with the lecture, now that you all know the story very well. So, the story is about the period. We are being told at the very first verse of the Book of Ruth that the time it took place, that was the period of the judges. The period of the judges. But, you know, I can today write a bad novel about the period of the judges, meaning the fact that it's about that period doesn't mean that it was written in that period. So when was the Book of Ruth written? That's the first question we have to ask ourselves if we want to understand the social, political, historical context, ideological context, into which the story actually was written. So one interesting element is it's named after a woman, the Book of Ruth. That's something that didn't happen in the First Temple period. All of a sudden, in the Second Temple period, we get some feminists, you know, and we get all these books named after women. We have Esther, we have Ruth, we have Judith, which didn't make it into our Bible, but it's in the Apocrypha, and we have Susanna, which is an addition to the book of Daniel in the Christian Bible, in the Greek Bible, first in the Septuagint and then into the Greek Bible. So all of a sudden we have four books named after women. So that's one interesting element. Number two. Now, she's perfect. Ruth is a perfect woman. And not only she, also Naomi is perfect. And also Boaz is perfect. Well, that makes the book a little boring, you know. So many perfect people. But that's, again, something you didn't see in older biblical literature. In the First Temple period, there are no perfect people around. They make sure that every person sins a couple of times. But in the Second Temple period, all of a sudden, we have perfect people. For instance, David, in the Book of Chronicles, David, who was so far from perfection in the Book of Samuel, the way he's presented in the Book of Chronicles, he's a perfect person. So that's a different mode, a different trend. So that, again, convinces me that I have to put Ruth into the Second Temple period. But I have more reasons to think that it was written actually at that period. When I say that Ruth is perfect and Boaz is perfect and Naomi is perfect, I should also say that the symmetry or the structure of the book is also very perfect. You know, there are four... I looked for board, but no. Oh, yeah, sure. Actually, I didn't want to find one. Yeah, but there are four chapters in the book. Four chapters in the book. And chapter 1 and chapter 4 are actually related one to the other. And chapter 2 and chapter 3, the two inner chapters are also related to one another. Like in the first chapter, for instance, we hear about the problems. Two problems, one national problem, the famine, and one personal problem or family problem. There is no continuity to the family. The first problem is being solved, the famine is being solved in the first chapter. The second problem is being solved in the last chapter when Ruth marries Boaz and there will be continuity to the family. In the first chapter, we got some information about the family, who's Elimelech, who's Naomi, etc., etc. And again, in the fourth chapter, we got information about the family. The book ends with a genealogy, with a list of 10 generations from Peretz, the son of Judah, until David. David is the last word in the book of Ruth. Another parallel between the first and the last chapter, God doesn't act overt, almost hardly acts overtly in the book of Ruth. Only twice he's active. The first time, again in the first chapter, when he puts an end to the famine in the land. And in the fourth chapter, where we are being told that God actually made it possible for Ruth to conceive. And God is not active at all in the inner chapters. Because if God is too active, if God is hyperactive, then there is no room for the human characters to show how nice they are. But if God stays in the shadow behind, then the human heroes can really act and show us how gentle they are, how nice they are to one another, etc. Another similarity between the first chapter and the last chapter, you know, we have in both chapters a minor character that sheds light on the protagonist. In the first chapter, we have Ruth and her sister-in-law, Orpah. Orpah is a nice girl. She wants to follow Naomi too to Bethlehem. But well, Naomi, with her rhetoric, convinces her to stay behind. So if you compare Ruth to Orpah, Orpah who is almost perfect, but Ruth is better than her, so then Ruth is really, really perfect. The same thing in the fourth chapter. You have the closer relative who was ready to redeem the field of Naomi to buy it, but when he heard that he with the field he gets also Ruth, a Moabite wife, he decided not to take it. And of course, Boaz, who is ready to do both, to take the field and to take Ruth. So you see how the two chapters are related to one another. Now, the two inner chapters, chapter 2 and chapter 3, chapter 2 tells you about one day in the field of Boaz. The day the two of them meet, Boaz and Ruth, she gets to the field. He knows who she is. He treats her very nicely, very generously. And in chapter 3 tells us about one night in the field of Boaz. That's the night when she uncovers his legs and you know how it ends. And both chapters, chapter 2 and chapter 3, start with a conversation between Naomi and Ruth and ends with expectations for the future. You know, in chapter 3, of course, the expectations are for the morning. They wait for the morning to see if Boaz is really going to marry Ruth. So, again, the structure is so very well organized, so very perfect. But if we talk about, you know, again, about the period in which the book was written, so there are more reasons to think that the book is actually from the Second Temple period. Well, the person who wrote the book of Ruth wanted it to be located between the book of Judges and the book of Samuel. By the way, that's where it is in the Christian Bible or in the Septuagint. But it's not there in our Bible. In our Bible, it's in the writings, you know, the third part of the Bible, the Ketuvim. How do I know, and I wasn't there, I'm pretty old, but I'm not old enough to be there and to know that that's what the author actually wanted, that, that was his idea. So how do I claim that I know it? First of all, well, I know that there are many doctors here, or at least my personal doctor is here. So, Dr. Kravitz, yeah. So, who took care of my cold this week. You know that in medicine, when you want to transplant organs, you have to make sure that the new organ won't be rejected by the body. And it's the same thing in biblical literature. When you transplant a new organ, you have to make sure that the environment will accept the new organ, that it won't be rejected. So the author of the Book of Ruth starts with saying that the book was actually, the story took place in the time of the judges. This way, you know, it finds its place next to the Book of Judges. Something else, the last chapter or the last story in the Book of Judges tells us about some woman, a concubine, that's a lower status of marriage, a concubine that leaves her husband, and she goes back to her daddy and mommy to Bethlehem. And her husband has follows her to Bethlehem and begs her to follow him back to his house. And now, if the Book of Ruth stands right after this story, you see the difference between these two women. The selfish concubine who left her husband in order to go to Bethlehem, and Ruth, who doesn't know what selfishness is, and she follows her mother-in-law to Bethlehem. So now we see how well it works, the beginning of the Book of Ruth and the end of the Book of Judges. And something else, the Book of Judges ends, now it's number one on your handout, the Book of Judges ends with the verse, "In those days there was no king in Israel, everyone did as he pleased." There was no king in Israel. We are waiting for a king, we want a king. And how does the Book of Ruth end? What's the last word? David. So we are waiting for a king, we are going to get one. Fine. Now, if we look at the end, at the end of the Book of Ruth, at the end of the Book of Ruth, number three on your handout, where the vipers, the women of Bethlehem, are praising Naomi for having such a nice daughter-in-law, and they are saying about the new grandson of Naomi, "He will renew your life and sustain your old age, for he is born of your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than seven sons." Asher hi tova lach mishiv'a banim. Now, how does the Book of Samuel start? In the Book of Samuel, you remember Hannah is barren, she has no children, and Elkanah, who's trying to be nice but he's not very smart, is telling her, number two on your handout, her husband Elkanah said to her, "Hannah, why are you crying and why aren't you eating? Why are you so sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" So you see, the Book of Ruth ends with a sentence very similar to the sentence we'll find in the first book of Samuel. So it becomes very clear that that's what the author of Ruth wanted to do, to put his book there. So why isn't he there? Because people told him, too late. This publisher of the prophets is already out of business. We don't accept any new books. You know, the Bible was canonized gradually. It was a long process. So the part of the prophets was already sealed. So they sent him, you know, over the street to the other side. Then there's a new publisher writings there. Try your mazal there, try your luck there. And he went over there. And that's why it's not there in our Bible. So it's again another sign that this is a late book. And of course, the language. You know, you can't fool all of us all the time. The author of the Book of Ruth did his best to write his book in First Temple period language. Yeah, perhaps he could fool his colleagues, but not me and my colleagues. He didn't succeed. Meaning he did a great job, you know, and I give similar assignments to my students to translate a biblical text from the First Temple period to the language of the Second Temple period. So they feel the differences between the languages. Because, you know, for Israelis in general, Hebrew is Hebrew, they understand it anyway. But the moment you have to start playing and translate it from one stage to another, then you realize that the Hebrew language is not is changing like any other living language. So the author of the Book of Ruth really tried to write in archaic language, but it didn't work. There are so many expressions, so many words, which actually entered our dictionary only in the Second Temple period. heavy influence of the Aramaic language. So it's clear again that it's a late book. And one more sign if you need one more. And, you know, every writer has a library behind him. You know, you can know what books a writer has read from his own writings, what allusions to what other pieces of literature he makes. And it's clear when you read the Book of Ruth that this guy knew almost the whole Bible, including late books like the Book of Chronicles, from which he borrows the genealogical list at the end of the book, or he knows the Book of Job. He really knows even late biblical books, from Genesis to Chronicles. He knows almost everything. So now I know it's a late book. Now that we know more or less that this book was written in the period of the return to Zion, Shivat Zion, in the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, that's the general period. Now we can ask ourselves, why was it written? What was the problem it tried to solve? What message did it try to express? And what we know about the period of Ezra and Nehemiah, that's the period when these guys, like the normative Orthodox Judaism of the early Second Temple period, they fought intermarriage. They fought it bitterly. And again, if you read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, they actually demand that people who married non-Jewish women should actually divorce them. And especially, and even if these women come and, well, there was no conversion like our conversion nowadays, but Ruth, for instance, what does she do? She says she accepts God and she actually embraces God and she embraces the people of Israel. She says to Naomi, Amech ami ve'elohayich Elohai. Your people is my people, your God is my God. And that's enough. So for these guys, it was not enough. Especially, they didn't like Moabite and Ammonite women. Why? Because there is a law in Deuteronomy number 6 on your handout. No Ammonite or Moabite shall be admitted into the congregation of the Lord. None of their descendants, even in the 10th generation, shall ever be admitted into the congregation of the Lord, etc., etc. So there is a law. What can you do? And again, this very law is indeed quoted in the book of Nehemiah, number 5 on your handout. Exactly. At that time, they read to the people from the book of Moses. The book of Moses is the book of the Torah. And reading from the book of Moses, what are they reading? And it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite might ever enter the congregation of God, etc., etc. A direct quotation from the book of Deuteronomy. And many people, indeed, after Torah was read, you know, sent their wives away, but 5 minutes later took them back. So anyway, that was the problem, that was the issue, that was the conflict. And you hear the demands of the, you hear overtly the demands and the ideology of the normative orthodoxy in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But where is the voice of the opposition? The voice of the opposition is the Book of Ruth. The Book of Ruth is a covert polemic against this ideology, telling us that marrying Ammonite and Moabite women, if they embrace God, it's fine. There is no problem. But how can the author of the Book of Ruth convince us that it's legitimate when you have such a clear law in the book of Deuteronomy? Let's now follow the process through which he takes us and convinces us that it's legitimate. When Ruth meets Boaz the first time they meet in his field, she asks him a question. Since he's so very generous to her, number 4 on your handout, she prostrated herself with her face to the ground and said to him, "Why are you so kind as to single me out?" Meaning to let me glean in your field to make sure that I won't come back home empty-handed. You take such a nice care of me when I am a foreigner. I'm not an Israelite, so why do you take such a good care of me? And actually, the whole book is an answer to this question. And how does it work? First of all, the answer of Boaz to Ruth is under number 7. Boaz said in reply, I have been told... Excuse me? No? Boaz said in reply, I have been told of all that you did for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and the land of your birth and came to a people you had not known before. Does it ring a bell? Does it sound familiar? Of course, next number on your handout, number 8, what God said to Abraham in Genesis 12, Lech Lecha, go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, etc., etc. Of course, the author of the book of Ruth creates this resemblance, you know, between the words of Boaz to the word of God to Abraham. So you'll see the truth is as good as Abraham. And she's better than Abraham. Much better. Why? Because Abraham, well, he was told by God to do it. And God, you see, God is actually giving him also a check and makes all these promises. He's going to make him a great nation. Ruth is not promised. First of all, God is not talking to her. Her mother-in-law tries to convince her to stay in Moab. She actually listens only to her inner voice, which tells her to follow her mother-in-law. And her mother-in-law tells her, look, you are not going to have a life in Bethlehem. You have nothing to wait. There is nothing waiting for you there. And despite everything, because of her loyalty and love to her mother-in-law, she goes to Bethlehem. So she is much better than Abraham. So how can you reject such a perfect lady? So, and then, of course, if you read number 9, after the two of them, Boaz and Ruth, get married in chapter 4, all the people at the gate and the elders answered, we are, meaning we are witnesses to this wedding. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, both of them of whom built up the house of Israel, prosper in Ephrata and perpetuate your name in Bethlehem. The people of Bethlehem compare her to the mothers of Israel, to the matriarchs of Israel. So she is now becoming like one of the matriarchs of Israel. So again, how can you reject her? And we can see, reading the book, that the author of the book of Ruth is very familiar with this, with biblical literature, makes all these allusions, and convinces us that, well, he's a member of the club. He knows very well biblical literature. He has the authority, you know, he has the power to express his opinion because he's no stranger. He knows his Torah very well. Now, the greatest problem with accepting Moabite and Ammonite women, it's not just the law in Deuteronomy. Because the moment I think about Moabites, about Moabite women, whom am I thinking about? I'm thinking this about the story of Lot and his daughters, because the daughter of Lot is the mother of all Moabites. And if you read, yeah, Susan is making this face, yucky. Yeah, exactly. It's a yucky story. It's a yucky story. How were the Moabites created? Oy vey. They left Sodom and Gomorrah, and Lot's wife turns into a pillar of salt, and Lot's sons-in-law died because they didn't leave the city. So now we have only Lot and his daughters, and they are in this cave on the mountain, and the daughters are afraid that there is no other man in the world, you know, to solve their problem, so there won't be continuity to the family. So they decide, well, they should have asked their father, because their father was told by the angels that it's a local Holocaust, it's nothing major, and there are enough men in the neighborhood, yeah, or in other neighborhoods. But, you know, they initiate this, have this great original idea. Actually, the mother of the Moabites, the elder daughter who says to her sister, let's make out, you know, let's make our father drink wine and let us lie with him. And we may maintain life through our father. That night they made their father drink wine, and the older one went and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down or when she rose. Thus the two daughters of Lot came to be with child by their father. Incest in the family. So do you want to have a relationship you know, with people who were created by incest in the family, and these two girls are behaving really badly. Because, you know, you can sleep with your father if you really want to, but at least don't be so overt about it, and the language they use. You know, I have addiction, a large vocabulary of words related to these very delicate matters. But the terminology they are using is very overt. And the worst part, when the son of the eldest daughter, Moav, is born, she gives him the name Moav, meaning Mayav. He is the son of our father. He is the son of my father. Mayav, for my father. Not very nice to put such a label on his forehead. He's walking around. Look, I was created by incest in the family. So, of course, look. Of course, if you ask the Moabites, you know, how they came into, how they were created, of course, that's not a story being told by Moabites. That's our private Israelite joke. You know, that's what we tell about these guys that we don't want to have any relationship with. Because, again, it's very dangerous, you know, it's very difficult to prevent Israelites from having a relationship with Moabites and Ammonites. They look like us, they sound like us, they eat the same food, hummus and tahini. You know, it's like, you know, family. And yet, they believe in other gods, so we have to be very careful. So the best way to make sure we are careful is to tell such a story about them. So every Israelite knew this story about the origin of the peoples Moab and Ammon. So now, how you convince the Israelites that it's okay to marry these women? Again, medicine will help me. Medicine will help me. You know, when the vaccine against polio was created, they used the microbe, or what is it? It's a microbe? Virus? What is it?
A virus.
Okay, thank you. So they used the virus itself, either the dead one or the living one. It depends if it's Dr. Salk or the other one. Okay, but you understand what I'm talking about. Fine. Your knowledge is medicine is much better than mine. So they used the virus itself in order to create the vaccine. And that's what actually the author of the Book of Ruth is doing. He knows that nobody can ignore this story. He knows that you are thinking about this story right now. So that's why he creates actually a scene very similar to the scene we have about the daughters of Lot. First of all, we have the same problem. Two guys died. Two women are still alive. We have to find a way to that this family will actually have a continuity. And women are the elder woman of the two is coming up with an idea how to continue with the family. And Naomi is indeed sending Ruth to the threshing floor of Boaz night time. That's number 11, I guess, on your handout. So she sends her there in the night time. And what else does she tell her? She tells her to get to the threshing floor, so bathe, something they didn't do every night. So bathe, anoint yourself, dress up, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not disclose yourself to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And she waits patiently until he eats and drinks, and only then she goes and uncovers his feet, and she's waiting. And he is waking up, surprised to see her there. Tell her, look, you cannot go back to the city right now. I don't want anybody to see you, you know, walking around nighttime. It's not very nice for a nice Moabite girl to walk around. So please stay here. But they don't do anything. There is no sex there. Because they have to wait for the morning. As I said earlier, there is a legal problem here. There is another guy, a closer relative, and he has the right to marry her if he wants to. So they have to wait for the morning. So in the morning, she goes back home. He goes to the gate where all the elders of the city are. And then when the other guy, the closer relative, rejects the idea, then, of course, Boaz takes her, and everybody, so including God, is so very happy about it. So you see now, you think about the story of the mother of all Moabites, but you see the difference. You see that Ruth is behaving so very differently than the mother of the Moabite. So how can you blame her for being a Moabite if she behaves so very differently? fine. Now, and another resemblance is created here to the book of Genesis, when Boaz, in chapter 4, after he takes Ruth, is blessed by the man there, number 12 on your handout, and may your house, they tell Boaz, be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman. So we are reminded of the story of Perez, of Judah and Tamar. Remember the story? Genesis 38, Judah, who becomes a widower, and two of his sons died. Again, two sons die, and again, there is no continuity to the family. And Tamar, who realizes that despite the promise of Judah to give her to his third son, he's not doing anything about it. She takes the initiative, dresses herself like a prostitute, sits there on the road, waits for Judah to pass by. When he sees a prostitute, he jumps, and they have sex. And then, only then, when she gets pregnant, she lets him know that actually he was the one to sleep with her. And that's actually how Perez and Zerah, are born. Perez, who is going to be the father of the Davidic line. And indeed, at the very end of the book of Ruth, as we said, we have the genealogy of 10 generations from Perez to David. So we are here reminded twice, of the story about Judah and Tamar and the birth of Perez. Why? Because if you Judahites look down in the Moabites, how were you created? So funny. Yeah, they can tell us, don't you remember how you, the house of David, were created? It's not a much better story than the one told about the Moabites. You know, Judah's daughter-in-law disguises herself as a prostitute, sleeping with her father-in-law, etc., etc. Again, incest in the family. So, don't say anything bad about the Moabites. So that's another way to convince us that we have to accept Ruth, actually. If that's not enough, so you see that we have found quite many allusions to stories of the book of Genesis. But now that we are going to interpret, in a very revolutionary way, a law in the book of Deuteronomy, a law which is an obstacle, we have to show that we know also biblical law and not only biblical narrative. Meaning the writer of the book of Ruth tries to show us how familiar he is with biblical law, and with his approach to biblical law, it will become possible to interpret the law of Deuteronomy differently. So one element of the law of the Torah that we actually are reminded of in the book of Ruth, when she gleans in the field of Boaz, number 15, when she got up again to glean, Boaz gave orders to the workers. You are not only to let her glean among the sheaves without interference, but you must also pull some stalks out of the heaps and leave them for her to glean and not scold her. Meaning what he expects his people to do is to pretend that they have forgot more and more sheaves and stalks, etc., so she'll have a lot to carry. When she goes home that night, she goes home with a truckload full of grain. It's like an amazing amount. So what is Boaz showing to us? You know that there is a law in the book of Leviticus, that's number 13, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap all the way to the edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not pick your vineyard, etc., etc. You should leave them for the poor and the stranger. I, the Lord, am your God. And then there is another law in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 24, verse 19. When you reap the harvest in your field and overlook a sheaf in the field, do not turn back to get it. It shall go to the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all your undertakings. If you follow the exact words of these two laws, the one in Leviticus and the one in Deuteronomy, you will realize that the author of the book of Ruth combines both laws. And that's a very interesting concept. What we have here is already a halachic midrash. Meaning, indeed, meaning when there are two different laws, but they talk about similar problems, or when they try to solve similar problems, what you should do is like a consolidation of these laws. Bring them together, bring them into agreement. And the author of the book of Ruth is actually talking here both about letting her to glean, but also everything that has been forgotten should be hers. But he is doing something else. Tell them to pretend that they, meaning the spirit of the law is much more important than the law itself. Whenever you read the law, think about it. Why is the law there? What was the idea behind it? If the idea behind it is to help poor people, so let them have more and more. And Boaz, who understands very well the spirit of the law, expects his people to behave better than, you know, the demands of the dry law. And that's very important, and that leads us to the next stage. You are all familiar with the law of levirate marriage in Deuteronomy chapter 25, meaning when two brothers dwell together and one of them dies, and dies childless, his brother should marry the widow of the deceased. And the first child to be born will be named after the deceased, as if he is the son of the deceased. So there will always be a continuity to the family, or to that branch of the family. Fine. And that's the law. And if the brother refuses to take his sister-in-law to marry her, we make sure we spit into his face and we do some ugly things to him, so he really feels bad and guilty. The Bible is all about guilt, no? Jewish, it's Jewish. Anyway, so yeah, so that's the you can read it. I don't want to read the whole Megillah here. You can read it to yourselves. But you know, in the case of the Book of Ruth, the law of levirate marriage is not valid because there is no son left alive to Naomi. Her sons are dead. So how are we going to solve her problem? There is no way. There is no law in the Torah that tells us how to solve this specific problem. But you know that the written Torah is like Swiss cheese, meaning there are more holes than laws. There's not, yeah, and if try to live your life even 1 week according to the written Torah, I'll come at the end of the week to see who's still alive. Without oral law, Torah Shebe'al Peh, you know, rabbinic stuff, Talmud, etc., you cannot really, which are all interpretations and reinterpretations and reinterpretation of the written law, without you cannot live your life. Fine. So how do we solve the problem of Ruth? Look, again, a person who goes by the law, let's say that she goes to some ancient rabbi and tells him about her problem, and he goes by the dry law, he'll tell her, go home, I can't help you. There's nothing here in the Torah. I read the whole Torah from the very beginning to the very end. Didn't find anything that, fine, bye-bye. Now, there is a law in the book of Leviticus, that's number 17 on your handout. If your kinsman is in stress and has to sell part of his holding, his nearest redeemer, his nearest karov, relative, his nearest goel, redeemer, but it means a karov, a relative, his nearest relative shall come and redeem what his kinsman has sold. Meaning, a piece of land can be sold only to a relative. So the first person you try to sell your piece of land too is your closest relative, meaning to your brother. If your brother cannot buy it, he has no means to buy, you go to your cousin. If your cousin cannot, you go to your second cousin. But you always try first with your closest relative. So, in the book of Ruth, we do have a problem of redeeming a field, meaning Naomi, who's now very poor, has to sell her piece of land. And that's why Boaz says to Ruth, well, you know, let's talk first to the closest redeemer, to the closest relative in the gate tomorrow. We'll see if he's interested in buying or not. But the book of Ruth goes further than that. The book of Ruth actually tries to combine the law of levirate marriage in Deuteronomy with the law of redeeming a field in the book of Leviticus. When we have such a problem with a woman whose sons are dead, the closest relative should not only buy her field, but also marry the widow. And the closest relative doesn't want to do it because he goes by the dry law and it's not according to the Torah. But again, the author of the book of Ruth tries to convince us there is something much more important than the dry law. Meaning, listen to the spirit of the law. Understand the spirit of the law. We want to take care of poor people. We want to care widows. We want to make sure that people who died will still have a continuity. And that's why he comes up with this great combination of these two laws. And now Boaz is indeed marrying Boaz. Boaz is not marrying Boaz. No, Boaz is marrying Ruth. And now everybody is so very happy. Everybody is so very happy. Boaz is happy. Ruth is happy. All Naomi is happy. All the women of Bethlehem are very happy. All the men of Bethlehem are very happy. And even God is happy. And that's the most important element. If you make God happy, it's a sign that everything is fine. And how do we know that God is very happy? Because number 19, so Boaz married Ruth, she became his wife, and he cohabited with her. The Lord let her conceive. In Hebrew, a literal translation of the Hebrew, and God gave her pregnancy. Vayiten Adonai la herayon. Yeah? And she bore a son. Think about it. The book of Ruth doesn't tell it overtly, but she was, like all matriarchs of Israel, she was barren. Because she was married like 10 years to her first husband before he died, and there were no children there. So she was, like all other matriarchs, a barren woman, and only at the end of the book, again, God solves her problem. Let her conceive, which means God is very satisfied with the novelty, with the new law, or with the combination of laws. God does not object to Moabite women being accepted into our congregation. And of course, but yet I have to ask myself, how is it possible, you know, to go against a clear biblical law? Because in the book of Deuteronomy, we read, let me remind you again, since you have already forgot, number 6 on your handout, Deuteronomy 23, verses 4 and 5. No Ammonite or Moabite shall be admitted into the congregation. Ha, ha, ha. Look how smart we are. The forms, grammatically, the forms which are being used are masculine forms. Because in Hebrew, usually, you use the masculine forms. You don't always have to say a man or a woman. You say a Moabite, and it refers clearly to a man and to a woman. Lo yavo amoni umoavi, bikhal Adonai. But when we really want it so badly to interpret the law differently, we can claim that the law refers only to the prohibition of admitting Moabite men and Ammonite men, and Ammonite and Moabite women are cordially invited to join the congregation. And indeed, this great story of the book of Ruth has changed the halacha. Because now in the Mishnah, Tractat Yevamot, chapter 8, Mishnah Gimel, Mishnah 3, we read, the male Ammonite and Moabite are prohibited, and the prohibition concerning them is forever. But their women are permitted forthwith, immediately. They can be accepted immediately. You see that halacha can be flexible. You know, if rabbis will just be flexible, if the halacha will still be flexible to meet the needs of us, of the Jewish people in the 21st century, we will all be very lucky. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, David.
There is another proof that last point. If it doesn't say any nationality, but if you take into prisoner a female, you are allowed to marry her, provided
right.
you give her
right.
time, and you can always take a prisoner,
right.
law-abide woman, and
right. Yeah, shvuya yefator, etc. Yeah, sure, of course. Yes.
I've never understood how a woman can go into a drunk man and make him perform sexually.
First of all,
it says it all to me. And this is the answer to all these things.
First of all, no, that's not the answer. He did, well, he drank one glass of wine for Kiddush. He didn't drink the whole, he did not drink the whole bottle. He's not drunk. No, he's alert. He knows exactly what he's doing. We don't want him to be drunk. We want him to, and what he says actually makes sense. He's, no, so he didn't get drunk.
Yeah, but I mean, for Lot,
like
He didn't, exactly, he didn't get drunk like Lot. He had his meal and drank a little, and that's what you drink. They didn't have bottled mineral water. The water was quite filthy, so he had to drink wine. But he didn't drink that much. Okay?
Actually, okay. The wine was diluted with water.
Exactly.
Wine cachet.
Uh-huh, okay. Fine. Yes, true.
What constituted a marriage during that period? In other words, was there a priest, just the father would decide?
Of course, first of all, the families had to decide, and then of course they said a couple of words, and we guess we know what was said by the man to the woman, because we have in the prophets, like in Jeremiah and in Hosea, you know, what God is actually telling the people of Israel. God is like the groom, and the people of Israel are like the wife. And when God is saying, "Ve'erastich li leolam, ve'erastich li bechesed," etc., we guess that's the formula that has been used for marriage. So they had a very simple, shorter ceremony than the one we have now. They didn't break a glass. Everything was fine. Yes?
Related to that, since this book, as you said, done in the Second Temple, what happened in that? Was this written then in Babylon?
No. A Second Temple period when they returned, after they returned to the land of Israel. Of course, in the land of Israel. Because that's where Ezra and Nehemiah, all these guys, objected to the marriage of Ammonites and Moabites. In Babylon, there were no Moabites and Ammonites around. Only in Israel you can find them. This Metzias. Yeah, Howard.
I can't remember the exact Hebrew in this part of Ruth, but the point at which she, after she's uncovered his
yeah.
feet, she actually lies down at his feet.
Yeah.
Was to sleep. And the word I think that it uses is raglayim.
Margelotav. Margelotav, which are not raglayim.
Okay.
Like at the bottom of his feet. That's
okay,
the meaning of the word.
Because previously you had said, you just answered my question. Previously
yeah, I know.
Raglayim
was
a euphemism.
Yeah, no.
But that's not the word
no,
it uses. So
no.
That's how you know that there's no
yeah.
sex actually.
Exactly. Okay. That's how I know. No, and actually.
He was there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, and another reason I know that there was no sex in the story, of course. We are not talking about real life, we're talking about the story, but the reason we know that there is no sex there, because that's what he's saying to her. Look, I cannot do anything because, well, there is a closer relative. We have to get to the gate in the morning and to find out if he's going to marry you or not. And if he's not going to do it, I'll do it. It makes no sense to sleep with him then, but I cannot actually marry her. You in the morning will get to the... Doesn't make sense, so of course.
He's a
finer man, sure. Ari.
Two questions. Is it Root? Is that name? Where is that name from?
We don't know. We don't know anything about the name. The only thing we know, and I've already told Ruti about it, that in the Syriac translation. Syriac, you know the Syriac translation, the Pshita. The Syriac is some kind of Aramaic. And in the Syriac translation of the Book of Ruth, the name is Re'ut, with an Ayin, Re'ut, which is friendship. Friendship, love. That's interesting. But it's not necessarily the original meaning of the name, but perhaps the translator or some interpreter tried to give the name a meaning to make. And since, you know, she's such a good friend, that's why they named her Re'ut. But we don't know what the... And even the rabbis are coming with different explanations of the name, but nothing to write home about. Yeah.
And then second, the ultimate argument here that the writer is making is that the King David comes from the relationship, right? So this is the ultimate justification.
Exactly. If King David, how can you complain against having a relationship with Moabites? If we wouldn't have had this great king of ours, King David, without
So, but if he's making up this argument, then he's making up that lineage.
Yes.
So,
no, he's not, because it has already been made. The lineage from Ruth. From Ruth, he is the one who makes it. Right. Yes.
So that's we accept that today as the lineage. But
sure.
Then up to that second temple period, that lineage was didn't people just read the book and say we just made that up?
Well, you know, first of all, he's smart enough again, because the part of putting Ruth into the relationship, that's his creation. Yes, but on the other hand, the 10 generations from Perez to David, that's already in the Book of Chronicles, in the genealogy of the tribe of Judah. And by the way, that's why you have to, he wants to start with Perez and end with David, because this way you get 10 generations. And 10 is a perfect number, because you have 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And you have 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. So again, 10 generations from Peretz to David. Wow, it's perfect. It's one of those perfect people, and etc. So you ask me a question, and I see the deep doubt on your face. Could he make something like that up? Take the New Testament. Take the New Testament, the first chapter of the New Testament. The genealogy of Jesus, you know, again related to David, and which was again a very nice artificial creation. And not only that, look at all the women that are becoming part of the family, of this holy family. For instance, Rahab. Rahab is actually the mother of Boaz, according to the New Testament. Rahab, the prostitute from Jericho, becomes like the mother of Boaz according to Matthew chapter 1. Yes, of course he made it up. So they had no problems making stories up. Only we have problems with it. Yes, Moshe. Moshe, please.
Isn't it an indication the fact that David is a descendant of a Moabite to show that God agreed to the fact that Moabite can be married?
Exactly. That's what Ari actually said. Yeah. That's putting David there at the end of the book is the ultimate proof, as Ari said, that it's legitimate. Yeah, of course. Yes. Howard?
Isn't there some evidence in the Book of Kings that David actually might have been not Jewish anyway, or not an Israelite?
No. First of all, in the Book of Samuel, look, again, the book... The Book of Samuel... The author of the Book of Ruth takes advantage of the fact that in the Book of Samuel you have no genealogy of David, so he can make one up. And why isn't there one in the Book of Samuel? That's a very interesting question, and I'm very glad you asked it. Or I asked it, actually. Because in the Book of Samuel, Samuel himself, who is presented to us in 1 Samuel chapter 1, you get the whole genealogy of the family. And then, for instance, chapter 9, 1 Samuel chapter 9, you get to King Saul, and again, you get the whole line. When you get to David, nothing. You know who his father is, but no grandfather, no great-grandfather, nothing. But something else is missing from the Book of Samuel. You don't have also a birth story for David. David was not born in the Bible. And can you imagine that people in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, in the first temple period didn't tell stories about the birth of David? So deliberately, the author of the book of Samuel decided not to tell us any story about the family, not to tell us any birth story about David, because the book of Samuel wanted to present David as a male Cinderella. Somebody whom we didn't actually expect to be like our hero. And if you read carefully tonight, our 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 1 to 13, 16, 1 to 13, and then chapter 17, you'll find so many parallels to the story of Cinderella. It's amazing, really amazing, how all, for instance, all the brothers are invited, you know, to the ball, to in the palace with Samuel to the party, and who's left behind? Little David. And all the brothers are presenting themselves as candidates to be the next king. David is not there, and only then when they realize that the glass sandal doesn't fit anybody, then they, well, don't you have any other son? Oh yeah, sure, I had the little one, I left it home. I left him home with the sheep, you know. Okay, girls, you live in the kitchen with the big pots, and him, David, you left with the sheep. The same thing happens in chapter 17, the story of David and Goliath. The older sons are being sent to the war to fight the Philistines. David stays home, but then his father sends him with some food to join to bring to his brothers. And when he gets there and he sees this Philistine giant, he is the one who's going to, of course, to fight, to marry the princess. And his brothers are mad at him for coming to the camp. You see the tension between, like a Cinderella story, between her and her sisters, between him and his brother. It's a typical Cinderella story. And Cinderella don't have a genealogy, and Cinderella don't have a birth story. Because if she has a birth story, then we cannot be surprised at the moment she's being chosen to be, etc. Okay, yes?
In the end, the book of Ruth, Naomi takes over the raising of the child.
Yeah.
And you don't, then nothing said about
Ruth has to work. What are grandmothers for? As if at the end of the book, actually, we have like almost a formal adoption of the little baby by Naomi, because Naomi is the one who lost a son. So, and the new son has to be a replacement for the son she had. So that's why she's the one who adopts the little baby. Yeah. More questions? No more questions.
No more questions? Okay, last question.
Yes.
Most of these stories in the Bible are known stories that people probably were familiar with.
Sure.
Right? But you inferred, I think, that this was a contemporarily written story. And I find it a little surprising that it was accepted for the Bible and
you know,
we don't know who the author is.
Yeah,
almost as if
no, I didn't meet him personally. Most stories are well-known traditions, you know, that are put into writing, and while being put into writing, necessary changes are being made. So the stories, the way they are written, fit our standards of religion, our ideologies, etc., etc. But some stories are being made up at a certain point. But again, you see, he's very careful, this writer. He's making a story up, but he's trying to make it as biblical as possible, meaning making allusions to so many biblical stories, using the archaic language of the first of the classical biblical Hebrew. So he makes it as biblical as possible. But you should not be surprised. Take the New Testament. No, and it took no time. It's amazing. It took no time. Within 50 years after the disappearance of Jesus, you already had like the four Gospels and many others that didn't make it into the New Testament, and with full reports about all the miracles, etc., of Jesus. And again, the very same procedure. So some of the traditions may have been, you know, historical, fine. I don't deny the existence of the historical Jesus. But yet you see that all other traditions are so very biblical. They try so hard to make him a second Moses, to make him a second Elijah, to make him very biblical. So that's the same thing you have here. That's what people did. They had no problem with it. Look, again, we are making this mistake again and again because we were born, I guess that all of us were born in the 20th century. Any exception? Anybody from the 19th? No. So, in the 20th century, actually already in the 19th century, we expected historians to write exactly what happened. But in the ancient world, they were much more creative than that.
Was it done by committee? Was it Sanhedrin?
No, you know what a camel is? A horse created by a committee. No, so nothing was done by a committee. It's a long, painful process. And there was no committee sitting and deciding what's to be included, what shouldn't be included. No, it didn't work like that. Thank you very much.